Subcommittee on Healthcare Access of the House Committee on Healthcare to order and open a public hearing on SB 163A that we didn't have a chance to do last time. I'd be happy to have this go as fast as we can have it go if there's no opposition. My problem would be since we haven't noticed a work session. I think it's the one I want to just pull out. Is that right?
Just announce you're going to schedule it
before. Yeah. If there's no problems with the hearing today and we're ready to move it, I'm just announcing I will schedule it in the full committee on Friday. Move it from the subcommittee to the full committee without a work session. And who do we have starting?
Chair Greenlee, members of the committee. My name is Walter Schaefer, and I'm the medical director for the Division of Medical Assistance Programs. And I'm testifying in support of Senate Bill 163A.
And you didn't come from 100 miles either.
And I did not come from 100 miles either. I came from up the street.
Oh, excuse me a moment. Could I ask everybody to turn off their cell phones? Not just silence them, but turn them off, because when they fire, even when they're silenced, they disrupt our recording systems. I'm sorry, Dr. Schaefer. Please go ahead.
Okay. So I have submitted written testimony, which I believe has been passed out, and I would just like to introduce this bill to you and make a couple of points. We also have John Pelkey here today from Division of Medical Assistance Programs, who will also give some testimony.
And you'll tell us what it's about, is that right?
And I'll tell you what it's about, yes. It's about the integration of behavioral health care and physical health care, which is actually one of the highest priorities of the Department of Human Services.
Would you like Mr. Pelkey to join you?
Sure, that'd be great. That'd be great. So at DHS, we've started a series of activities between the Division of Medical Assistance Programs and the Addictions and Mental Health Division and Public Health Division. And those activities are to identify and break down barriers to coordinated unified care. This year, DHS is expecting each of the mental health organizations and each of the managed care organizations that care for Oregon Health Plan clients to develop collaborative projects initiating or advancing combined systems of care. So one of the barriers to this integration of care is a restriction on the exchange of health information contained in current statutes. The statute on mental health information release is more restrictive, creating situations in which at times the mental health organizations are reluctant to release patient information to medical plans. Senate Bill 163A seeks to clarify that the exchange of protected health information is allowed in the specific context of mental health organizations and managed care medical organizations working together. The original bill contained, in the last phrase, you probably have the amended bill in front of you, but it contained the phrase integrated behavioral and physical health care. And an amendment was made on the Senate side to change the wording so that it now reads in the last phrase, the managed care health services organization is providing behavioral or physical health care services to the individual. So hopefully that makes a clarification.
I think we have the A and Gross version.
Okay, good. So hopefully it's clear that the intent is to allow the exchange of information in this limited setting between behavioral health care organizations and medical health care organizations that are providing care to this same individual. So I'd be happy to answer questions, or we can hear from John Pelkey first.
Pelkey, would you like to?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Chair, Representative Greenlick, members of the committee. I'm John Pelkey, the Quality Improvement and Medical Section Manager for the Division of Medical Assistance Programs for the Department of Human Services, and I am here also to testify in favor of Senate Bill 163. As Dr. Schaefer indicated, we are interested in promoting integrated care in order to improve health outcomes and to develop and improve patient-centered health care delivery systems. This really is a priority within both the Department of Human Services and also from the Governor's Mental Health Task Force to foster integration of behavioral health care and physical health care. And this legislation removes a current barrier to creating that seamless system of primary care of physical health and mental health. And I would say that the exchange of aggregated data on diagnosis and treatment is necessary for new approaches to collaborative care. And I would also point out it's really critical for our collective efforts in clinical quality, performance improvement. Each of us needs to be dedicated to achieving that clinical quality second to none for our clients and our patients. And clinical quality performance requires sharing key data, which will help to drive those performance efforts. Expanding and supporting clinical quality performance is a critical focus in the Division of Medical Assistance Programs, and this legislation really supports those efforts. And just briefly, a good example I like to use is the connection between heart disease and depression. It's now recognized that patients who have depression or other mental health symptoms are also at elevated risk for heart disease or other cardiac problems. And conversely, those patients with heart disease who have had a heart attack or a cardiac problem are also at elevated risk for depression. So those two systems, the mental health providers and those that provide cardiology and cardiac services, both need to recognize the connection and work in collaboration for improvement of the healthcare system, which would serve both the mental health and the physical health needs of the person. So SB 163 is an important step to support this effort to promote integrated health care, improve health outcomes, and really treat the whole person as part of that patient-centered delivery system. So thank you very much.
Question?
Yes, please.
I'm not sure who'd like to answer this, but as I'm looking at the bill, I'm wondering if it is expanding the ability for the state to disclose information without a release. Presently, is a release required to from a patient to release any physical health information?
Chair Greenlake, Representative Richardson, for generally for individual patient care needs between providers, a specific release is required. However, for release between for the situation that's referred to in the bill, there is some lack of clarity in the current statutes as to whether release is required. The bill makes reference to 179.505, which is basically covers the mental health release of information, and there are some provisions in there which say that disclosure is allowable without specific release when it's essential for research, evaluation, review, audit, etc. So there are some situations where a specific patient release is not required now. It's just that the health plans are not certain of where the boundaries are. And this will clarify the boundaries. So it's either an expansion of what's allowed without a specific signed release, or it's a clarification.
The reason I bring this up is in the Senate the word or was added instead of and. And so now it says a state health plan or a prepaid managed health care service organization may disclose protected health information of an individual without obtaining an authorization from the individual to another prepaid managed care health service organization for treatment when the prepaid managed care health organization is providing behavioral or physical health care services. So that means it doesn't have to relate to physical health care at all. I mean, behavioral health care at all, because it says or. It's now disjoined. And so now that you can have a release of information from one organization to another if either one of them is providing physical health care services. And so if...
physical or being.
Yeah, but see, you used to say and. And so now it says or, so what I'm wondering is there going to be an unintended consequence of expanding this so that now you don't need a release if you're providing physical health care where before you did.
For the same individual.
For the same individual.
Representative Richardson, I'll tell you why I think you don't have to be concerned about that. First of all, the various prepaid managed care health services organization pretty much identifies this as, if it's a physical health organization, it's for Oregon Health Plan clients, and they can only be a member of one physical health plan organization at a time. So when it's referring to the individual, which is, you know, at least in the last phrase, there will only be one physical health plan at a time that the individual would be a member of. So I don't think this would apply in that case. The individual may be a member of a physical health organization and a mental health organization, and that's actually the situation that this addresses. Whether the wording is clear enough to say that, I think it is if you look at the definitions of the prepaid healthcare health services organizations.
I have to say, it truly is hard to figure out what 179.505 says. Trying to make sense out of that is that's a pretty murky and complex.
Chair Greenlick, I think that's the problem, and I think that's why this bill has been written, to clarify, to make a clearer statute on what can be released, particularly for the mental health organizations.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Representative Maurer.
I would concur that...
I'm trying to get Representative Kotek down. Yeah, that's what I was just trying to organize here to get her.
You know, I do have a question about...
out of the community.
This whole issue of privacy and HIPAA and the just the vast amount of confusion that's taken place as a result of HIPAA and people overreacting, clinics overreacting, hospitals overreacting, you know, because they think they might be in violation when in fact that's totally, you know, erroneous. And I'm also concerned with the state of Oregon. It may have overreacted in some of its statutes because it's very unclear, murky as the word, that we are actually harming patients because providers are so paranoid about sharing information that really is relevant to the care of these patients. And I guess my question directly is, has that been revisited, the whole issue of what Oregon has piled on top of the federal HIPAA law to, you know, to see if we can unbundle some of this stuff to make it more streamlined so we can provide integrated care appropriately? You know, because the intent has never been to violate patients' privacy. The intent is to provide good care.
Right. Chair Greenlake, Representative Maurer, I think we're not trying to address the whole of the uncertainties and the problem that you've identified, but it is definitely a problem, and it is forming a barrier to the type of integrated behavioral and physical health care that we're trying to create in the healthcare system. So I think what's happening is that because there are so many uncertainties about the current statutes, organizations are afraid to test the boundaries, and so they have the impression, or at least an apprehension, that certain information can't be released from a mental health organization to a physical health organization, for example. And because of those apprehensions, they just don't do it. They don't want to take the risk. And so at least this bill is trying to clarify that in this particular limited setting, it is legal to exchange the information. So,
I think we had some time. We really should take a look at 179505, which I think does exactly what you're worrying about.
Well, and when we pass mental health parity, you know, I think that those barriers need to come down further, and there really is a sense of, you know, of paranoia, may not be the right word, but, you know, the possibility that you're going to have a complaint filed against you as a provider because you inappropriately disclosed some, you know, PHI. And it just has confounded me that the state has piled on, because the federal law is pretty clear in what's appropriate, what's inappropriate. And it seems like Oregon may have overstepped that boundary. So.
Well, I think that's the place to look, because I think you're right. I mean, the basic principle ought to be, if you need to get health information about an individual to help that information, that individual get the treatment he or she needs, then you ought to be able to get that information for the good of that individual.
And conversely, if you inappropriately disclose it, then we need to be harsh in the retribution, because that's just as damaging.
It is toxic. Thank you. Well, thank you both very much. Can we have Jim Russell and Cindy Becker to give us a little more clarity on this situation? And I, again, for all of you, I apologize that we didn't get to you on Friday.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cindy Becker. I'm the director of the Coalition for Healthy Oregon. To keep it short and sweet, we 1,000% support this bill. Initially, we were the ones actually that asked for the amendment of 163, because to Representative Richardson's question, actually, the last phrase did say and that was a problem, because it made it look like a single organization had to provide both the behavioral and the physical health. And that was not the purpose of the legislation, of the bill. It was so that organizations who serve the same individual can share information. Also, to Representative Maurer's question, several years ago when I worked for the state, there was a Noah's Ark group of representatives from the Medical Association, the Hospital Association, Human Services, Consumer and Business Services, that looked at all the HIPAA statutes and all the state statutes. And as difficult as they are now, they're probably better than they were. That's not to say they shouldn't be looked at again, but there was a huge effort that was, it took at least a year to really do that crossover. So I'm sure other folks can have a better memory of it, but I was on the committee, and when I left the state, I tried to erase that memory. So anyway, we do support this bill. It's very much needed. When you've got doctors and clinicians serving the same individual, we really need to be able to share that information for a variety of reasons, whether it's for pharmaceutical reasons or for physical health and mental health reasons. It's just the right thing to do, so we support this 100%.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Jim Russell. I'm the director for Mid-Valley Behavioral Care Network. That's one of the mental health organizations. And I've spoken with my peers about this bill, and particularly wanted to come up with Cindy and for you to be able to hear from an MHO firsthand that this bill makes sense to us. I've offered something in writing, particularly I'm referring to a memo that looks like this. And to some of the questions asked already, I think what this does is gives us an opportunity to identify people who are receiving services from both parts of the Oregon Health Plan. On the one hand, you could think the Oregon Health Plan is one insurance company. We're not really going outside of that insurance company to be having this conversation. But as several people have drawn out, there is some concern about this. I've been working in the mental health field for 30 years, and we're very strongly trained not only in this state, that even if a spouse were to call up the program saying, I need to pick up my husband after his appointment is done, the receptionist will not acknowledge that he's there because of the special protections accorded to people receiving mental health care. This would make it clear that we can at least acknowledge a member that we have in common for individual treatment. Partly, as Cindy said and others have said, if you look at my middle paragraph in this memo, I'm talking about the opportunity to identify people that we're both serving and then to get their permission to coordinate that care. And then, as you've heard from the original speakers and can understand, this gives us an opportunity, as I mentioned in my fourth paragraph, to pursue system improvements. And on the back of my memo, I've included a flow diagram. In 2002, as a few people in the room would remember, this state funded several projects they called targeted case management. They wanted to pursue some collaborations between fully capitated health plans and mental health organizations. One of my peers, ABHA, Accountable Behavioral Health Alliance, wanted to do a collaboration with the health plan in Central Oregon and the other MHO involved in Central Oregon. And my friend tells me that it took 2 to 3 months of their attorneys working on the ability to share information about who was being prescribed psychotropic medications by primary care providers so that they could set up this project of advising the primary care providers on better use of psychiatric medication. So he was very enthusiastic about this bill, not able to be here this afternoon. So I commend it to you, and if there are other questions, I'm grateful that I didn't get all the arcane HIPAA and 179 questions, but if you have questions, I'll do my best.
Are there other questions, these witnesses? Well, thank you very much. If anybody wants to get any more information to us before Friday, I suggest they do that. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 163A and open a public hearing on HB 2177 and HB 2183. And I'd like to start that session. I'd like to call Jeanine Smith up to talk about the general state of where OHP standard is right now and give us some overview on that will be useful as we consider both of these bills.
Chair Greenlick and Vice Chair Richardson and Vice Chair Cannon and members of the committee, thank you very much for inviting me. I'm Jeanine Smith, the Administrator of the Office of Health Policy and Research, and handed out to you is an overview that I won't go through in total detail, but just wanted to give you some highlights of some of the findings we've done through our office in a collaborative called the Oregon Health Research and Evaluation Collaborative, which was a combined effort with our Oregon universities and local health researchers in the state, and was funded by a grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. And what we were trying to do was get a feel for what had happened when there were cuts to the Oregon Health Plan back in 2003, and we did a economic impact study, and we also did a survey of enrollees who were on the plan at the time of the changes, and then followed them over three waves of a survey to see what happened to them. And some of this, some members have seen before, and I won't go into all the details of all the changes, but this was presented during past legislative session and interim committee hearings as well. But as you remember, the benefits were split between OHP Plus and Standard. There were premiums adjusted up somewhat. There were already premiums in place. We did, however, start requiring those in zero income to start paying premiums, and we no longer allowed them to wait 6 months to pay. If they couldn't pay every month, they had a six-month catch-up period. We had changed that, and we had added some significant co-pays and eliminated certain benefits. And moving on to the slide that says, so what happened, is we saw impacts on access, enrollment, and utilization, and I'll go through some of those fairly quickly for you. But what we found was that there was a higher unmet need for those who had lost coverage. 60% reported just overall unmet need, and especially those with mental health, there was even a higher unmet need. We, as you remember, we had cut outpatient mental health services. Persons with chronic illness who lost coverage were more likely to report that need, and the main concern was the increased costs. And next one is a slide showing kind of the disproportionately affecting those in the lowest income group. The next slide is impacts on enrollment, and we saw a 45% decline in the months immediately after OHP2 was implemented. And this was most notable the month after we started requiring them to pay back immediately. And low income were the most significantly affected by this. And the next slide is the one that many of you have already seen, but it is a the decline in the lowest of income. That's a 0 to 10% at that top line. And subsequently, we have changed the premium policy, and so those folks are no longer required to pay premiums. But it was a fairly steep decline at that time. Our economists that did some detailed work looking at the numbers found that the zero-income group dropped sharply, as I said, 9.5% versus 5.5% for those in other income brackets, and premiums was the most common reported reason. And most of those who lost coverage remained uninsured. And we found it was more due to that premium collection policy than it was the actual total amount of premium. On our survey of following those folks who were on and then what happened to them, we found that most of them did not find other insurance, and the pie chart on the next page sort of outlines those folks. So they basically became uninsured, and all the characteristics in which you would find uninsured having similar problems of getting access to care. So that takes us to utilization, and we found that those who lost coverage were nearly three times more likely to have no usual source of care, and they were more likely to skip prescriptions than those who were remaining on OHP. And the economists have examined some of the data in Medicaid expenditures and found that those clients who were on used methadone had expenditures increases by $144 per member per month due to the increase in inpatient admissions. Again, this was during the time that we had no outpatient care. And inpatient use and expenditures increased. Inpatient use increased about 22% and expenditures increased about 17%. And those who were using the ED and some other ambulatory services, although they had decreased use, they were ill, more ill or sicker, I guess you could say, with because there was increased expenditures per user. So even though our original attempts were to lower costs, these co-pays and benefit changes in combination seem to end up costing us at least the same, if not a little bit more. Next slide just talks about what happened to that we also found through our survey with the individuals, that they're 4 to 5 times more likely to go to the emergency room for care, and this is particularly true for those with chronic diseases. And the last slide just kind of catches you up to date in that we did reinstate mental health and chemical dependency services in 2004. And the hospital and managed care tax is what is funding OHP standard. There's no general fund dollars at this time. The OHP enrollment has been frozen since July 1st. I don't have the most accurate numbers. The DHS it estimates it's about 23 to 24,000, and the copays were eliminated per court ruling. And with that, thanks to our multiple researchers who worked very hard collectively to do these studies. So I'll stop there. And have any questions for me?
Any questions? I mean, as you've gone through this, there's statements and then conclusions drawn. My recollection was that the funding for the standard was like $117.2 million that was funded, that was not used because of the decrease in, I mean, there was money set aside, but then the plan was cut substantially back. And so when you say, those who have lost coverage were more likely to skip filling a prescription due to cost, 57% versus 48% of those remaining on the Oregon Health Plan. You're really saying there was a 9% decrease in those who skipped filling prescriptions among those that didn't have the coverage and those that remained on the Oregon Health Plan. And so the conclusions are, you know, I understand the conclusions, but I don't understand the data to support them.
That was the Chair
Richardson. Saying that one little thing is
that one little thing is from a survey instrument. It was where we surveyed those still on the plan and those no longer on the plan, and so comparing the numbers between those on and off by self-report whether they were skipping prescriptions or not. So that's from a different data source than the actual expenditure data analysis. We did sort of three aspects of trying to get an answer of what was happening. We surveyed the emergency room data set, we surveyed the Medicaid data set, and then we surveyed the actual people. And so that it was the 57% was compared if you took the group who answered our survey.
No, I understand what I said. So what I'm saying is that the difference actually between them is 9%. It's less than 10%. And so it's not as that by itself is not hugely substantial. There's an issue about coverage as compared to, you know, care, meaning FQHCs, other safety net clinics, and other access besides just the emergency room. I guess what I'm wondering is, what is the bottom conclusion? Is the bottom conclusion that there was more than $117 million spent in the system than would have been spent had they stayed in standard and had been fully funded? I'm trying to find what you're really saying.
Yeah. Chair Richardson on the committee, I don't know if we could take it to that large of a conclusion that we couldn't really calculate the costs of care of the uninsured to make that full calculation. I mean, I can ask the researchers if they have any sense of that, but I can't say we ever asked them to put the full piece together of should we keep them uninsured and how much did that cost versus we just had the analysis of what we spent collectively of those who stayed on the plan. And some of those costs went up individually amongst and maybe less use of some services, but overall they were a little sicker. But we can't really quantitate exactly what the cost was for those who fell off. You know, all we can get is their self-report. But maybe I'm missing your...
No, I don't understand. I don't understand your questions. Or not me. What was that $117 million?
There was in the budget in 0305, $117.2 million that was put in DHS's budget to fund standard population as if there was no decrease. And then we had the tax increase, and then we had Measure 30, and then, you know, and all this talk about, you know, people under the bridges and all of this, and we got this huge problem if Measure 30, if the tax increase didn't go through, the people voted it down, and then DHS came up with, guess what? There's $117.2 million that's funded for a program that we're not really paying for, and so we can use that to backfill. I mean, that's kind of the brief.
So $117 actually got spent on standard?
No, it didn't, because standard was already coming down. I think standard, my recollection of standard, was being funded at like 85,000 or 87,000, but at the time of the budget, it was already down through 45,000 on its way down to 20-some thousand.
Right, I see.
And so there was money actually just squirreled away that in case the tax increase didn't go through, but that wasn't openly discussed. But then when that money came forward after the tax increase failed, it was used to backfill other programs.
Other DHS programs.
Other DHS programs, which didn't help the populace, the voters' confidence that we really couldn't come up with the money if they didn't pass the tax increase. And so what I was really wondering is, having gone through this, basically the conclusion was that we paid more when people are not insured. And what I'm saying is, well, I'm not sure what
in the cost shift.
In the cost shift, is that really the case? There's no discussion about FQHCs and other safety net clinics and other things like that. And so I'm just trying to understand.
Chair Greenlick and Vice Chair Richardson, the only one of the economists who worked on this project has looked at some numbers in Oregon, and it's about 9% of the commercial premium is related to uncompensated care coverage. That was presented in the Senate Interim Committee, Dr. McConnell. So, but as far as quantifying how much was used in the various clinics, we didn't have funding to go out and get the data from who uninsured being, you know, those who fell off the plan and following them where they did get care and quantifying that.
Okay, thank you.
I heard Representative Richardson ask another question in past days about how many of those 75 or 100,000 that disappeared from OHP standard ended up on OHP plus. Do you have any sense of how many that turned out to be?
Chair Greenlick and Representative Richardson, there was a certain number because previously those you had to be fully disabled and they went through more paperwork to be able to qualify and maybe they hadn't really needed to prior, but I don't have the actual number on the top of my head. We do know the majority who fell off never got any insurance at all, but I can get you that, find out if there's
was there a bump in the OHP plus that looked like, oh, here's...
There was, when the economists started looking, there was a few bumps, but there was some other reasons for the bumps. It wasn't just because we thought at first it was the shift over, but it was due to some other regulation changes and things that contributed to that bump. But I can check with Dr. Wallace and Dr. McConnell and get back to you with an official answer.
I'm sure Dr. Goldberg has that in his back pocket. We can ask him.
Of course he does.
Are there other questions for Dr. Smith?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Smith, thanks for being here, and thanks for the review of what we were doing with health plan in the standard population. I like this chart with the, you know, the decreasing trend of who's in the program. I think we have to remember, too, that, remind me if I just want to double check that I have this right, you know, half the folks who lost coverage were parents, and therefore that was affecting their children's access to care probably because they were uninsured. Is that, am I remembering that correctly?
No, Representative Kotek, Chair Greenlick, this is all adults. OHP standard was all adults, but yeah, there is some percentage of those who probably did have kids. I can't remember the exact number when we parsed it out.
And follow up? Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just in the discussion around the cost shift, maybe we don't have the causal relationship, but we might have the correlation that as we've seen the number of uninsured in the state rise and the shift to the cost in terms of for insurance premiums, that we have to take a look back at the standard population because that's where we lost folks in the Oregon Health Plan. And I don't know if – do you have any other studies in the process in terms of looking at that population?
Representative Kotek, Chair Greenlick, as I said, Dr. McConnell has been doing, we haven't quite totally finalized it about what the uncompensated care, trying to understand uncompensated care better. We don't have any further studies at this point on the OHP standard other than we have the final third wave of the survey data that I haven't seen the absolute final analysis. And we started to do a study, got a little bit more money from Robert Wood Johnson to look at the impact of dental care as a consequence of the changes. And we hope to have that by the end, by June. But we finally got some interest in getting someone to fund us to look at that. But to also understand, this is also in the backdrop of a declining economic conditions, and so there was a lot. When we looked at the ER usage, there was a lot of uninsured in the ER, but we can't really say that's all because of OHP standard. Some of it was also because of the economy and people losing employer-sponsored insurance at the same time.
Thank you. Can I, one just final?
Anything
thank you. I just wanted to mention for the committee that we were at Ways and Means this afternoon. We're reviewing the mental health and A&D budget. And from their calculations, they lost about $25 million in A&D treatment into the whole system when the standard dropped off as it did. So it was a real impact for the delivery service and those services, particularly for this population. So there are other impacts across the system that we haven't probably totally, quantified.
I remember hearing that 70% of all the outpatient A&D treatment dollars disappeared with this population.
Large.
I have one more question. The chair Representative Kotek just talked about. I'm kind of astounded by the huge drop in the less than 10% of the federal poverty line. How come that population was hit so much more dramatically than the other population? Is that because of the premium?
Representative Greenlick, we believe it's more of the having to pay so quickly. The amount is about the same. The difference only before and after was that we used to have a discount if you were a couple in a family that you didn't pay $6 a piece, you paid $8 or something, $9 I think it was. And then all we did really change was that it would be $6 for both of them. So there was that. There was the impact of both parents needing to pay. But the other thing was just that needing to pay every month right on time, and there was issues about even getting the money in. But the problem really was that some months they would have the money and some months they wouldn't, but they maybe wouldn't have the money every single month. And that's sort of what we would hear. We heard, I think, some anecdotal stuff through the survey about the difficulties in getting the premium in on time.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, for sure.
Thank you. Thank you. Just a quick question on copays. Can you give us a sense of what those tend to be? Is there a standard copay?
Representative Cannon and Chair Greenlick, what we tried to do in OHP standard was fairly significant copays in relation to what normal Medicaid copays. Usually Medicaid only allows you what are called nominal copays that are like from $1 to $3, maybe at the most $5. What we had asked through the waiver was much more significant of $5, $10, $15. The hospital copay was $250. We don't charge those any further because we're not allowed to due to legal lawsuit, but we originally were charging those higher copays. It was tiered copays for prescription drugs. So they were significantly higher than what the typical Medicaid copays are.
Thanks.
Yeah. Follow up, because I wasn't going to bring it up, but Representative Cannon opened that line of questioning. It had to do with the copays. So can you give me a little history on this court case or why? Because I guess where I'm seeing this is that there was a period of time when we started collecting copays from patients, $3 a visit. And that was actually a discourager for a number of patients who stormed, you know, they come in and ask to be seen, and we had them scheduled, and then they would storm out saying that they didn't have the $3 copay. And so there were a number, and it happened a number of times, and all of a sudden it stopped. And in your day-to-day business, you don't really worry about that. But so can you give us a little history on how that?
Chair Greenlick and Representative Maurer, I am no way a lawyer, so I will not be able to give you the legal reason. But the waiver was approved, and I think there was the copays went into effect in February or March, and then there was a legal challenge to them whether the federal government had the authority to give us a waiver of doing copays at that larger amount. Than what is considered nominal Medicaid. And so then when the lawsuit was concluded, it was decided by the court that the federal government did not have the authority to give us a waiver on that significant of copays. So the copays were stopped. And so that's why they went away. But it was a discussion of cost sharing in general, and premiums were allowed to continue anyway, so we are currently prohibited from putting copays on the OHP standard population based on the current way our current waiver is.
In the 2005 session, we stopped cost sharing with the under 10%
correct
population as well. Thank you very much, Dr. Smith. Can I call a very high power panel here, Dr. Bruce Goldberg, Jim Scherzinger, and Lynn Reed, talk to us about 2177 to 2183. Lynn, I think this may be the first time you've been here. Is that right?
That may be true, Mr. Chair.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bruce Goldberg, Director of the Department of Human Services.
Lem Reed, Deputy Administrator with the Division of Medical Assistance Programs within the Department of Human Services.
Jim Scherzinger, Deputy for Finance.
We're here to give you a brief overview and talk, I hope briefly, about House Bill 2183 and 2177. And I think that Dr. Smith set the stage for these. These are both provider taxes. I'm going to actually back up a little bit further than where she started. We worked on both of these provider taxes in the 03 legislative session. Specifically, these are taxes for our Medicaid managed care organizations. That's House Bill 2177, and taxes on our hospitals. These are our DRG urban hospitals, House Bill 2183. We began these in 2003, really to do a couple of things. First was to really round out what had been a benefit package for Oregon Health Plan that couldn't quite fit in the budget that was allotted. And secondly, was to improve provider rates in the Oregon Health Plan. I think as many people know, the provider rates in the Oregon Health Plan haven't kept pace with cost. And we entered into a collaborative agreement with those who were being taxed to be able to do this. That was the original intent. We worked very hard. We all sat around the table for several months and worked out the details that allowed both the state as well as the taxpayers to come forward jointly, be able to put this tax on the table. It allowed us some additional revenue, which we then were able to use to leverage some additional federal funds, and we were able to achieve the objectives for which we began these taxes to do. That changed, and that changed at the time Dr. Smith talked about, when following the passage of Measure 30 and budget cuts, we changed our the intent of the taxes at that point, or at least not the intent, but we changed the purpose of those taxes. We sat around with the stakeholders and looked to use those taxes to be able to continue to provide services for individuals on OHP standard. And indeed, that's what now these taxes do, is the combination of these two provider taxes along with the federal match that they draw down allows us to provide services to a little less than 24,000 people in OHP standard. We've had a history of working collaboratively with those taxpayers, and these bills that you have before you today are really just extending the sunset of those bills until October 1 of 2009. That's in its simplicity what these two bills do is merely allow us to continue to do what we've been doing and extend that sunset till 2009. I'm going to let Lynn talk a little bit about the dollars and cents and the numbers of individuals that we're able to take care of as a result of these taxes, and Jim to talk for a moment about how it works, and then open it up for questions.
Thank you. Members of the committee, Mr. Chair, Since the start of the provider taxes through the most recent completed tax collection period, which was in December 2006, these two taxes have brought in approximately $226 million in provider tax revenue from hospitals and Medicaid managed care plans. When we use that revenue for Medicaid purposes, we can draw down federal matching funds. And the federal matching funds that would accompany that amount of provider tax are $361 million. So together, the provider tax with the federal matching funds puts $587 million into the health care for Oregonians, and it's directed at the Oregon Health Plan standard population, that group of adults who don't qualify otherwise for Medicaid programs. We're currently serving about 21,000 OHP standard clients in the program. Extending the sunset on the two taxes and moving into the next biennium, there will be enough revenue in 07-09 from the provider taxes along with federal matching funds to serve 24,000 OHP standard clients. The amount of revenue that that would be generated by the extension of the tax, House Bill 2177 and House Bill 2183, is about $190 million in tax revenue. When combined with the federal funds, that adds another about $300 million to that for $490 million or so total funds that would go into the system. So with that, I'll turn it to Jim.
The bills themselves, House Bill 2177 and 2183, are actually fairly straightforward, just a single page apiece, and all they do is extend the sunset date, as Dr. Goldberg said, of the current provisions of the law through October of 2009. So that's very brief.
Richardson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions. One is, you mentioned that initially there was some reference to the rate of reimbursement, and there's been a lot of discussion about that. Would one of you give us an explanation as to what the expectations were by the providers as far as rate of reimbursement when this was implemented, and whether or not the state has done what it was had intended to do or what was committed to do?
Vice Chair Richardson, Chair Greenlick. I don't recall an exact figure as to what the commitment was around rates, but what I can say is that we certainly have not achieved that, and we hadn't seen a substantive increase in sort of net rates since we began the tax. We have increased rates to the extent that we can in fee for service to hospitals, and but that has not been, you know, that's been also offset by certainly some of the tax that's been paid as well.
Will we be hearing from providers today?
Mr. Chair, if they signed up, we will.
Yeah, have they signed up?
Question, I'll save, but I would like to ask, we're at a present population of 21,000. This is geared to fund at 24,000. My understanding is that it has been geared to fund at 24,000 in the past, so why are we 3,000 under what was intended?
Vice Chair Richardson and Chair Greenlick, the 24,000 is an average over the course of the biennium. For the current biennium, we started the biennium above 24,000, and that number is an average across the biennium. That's why it's currently lower. we hope when we have the ability in terms of both cash flow as well as the passage of these bills and the certainty going forward in the future, that we will at some point be able to open up OHP standard to get to a point where we can look to have approximately 24,000 individuals over the course of the biennium.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for the additional information. Question about the MCO tax. The bill extends to October 2009. Could you tell us a little bit about the Deficit Reduction Act and what happens with that tax? We move forward the status quo, but we have an issue in October. If you want to get into that, that'd be great. October of 2009.
Sure. Representative Kotek and Chair Greenlick, there are a couple of issues with actually all provider taxes, but let me focus on the managed care tax. For starters, from a federal perspective, you're referring to the Deficit Reduction Act. Under the Deficit Reduction Act, our ability to have a provider tax that is solely focused on Medicaid managed care organizations will go away under the Deficit Reduction Act, and that is in, I believe it's October 1 of 2009. At that point, the language is such that we cannot have a tax solely for Medicaid managed care, but it would have to be broad-based across all managed care in the state. The second issue, although not directly related to the Deficit Reduction Act, but I think it's important to note for the committee, is the percentages that we can tax. There are ceilings on these taxes, and up until recently, those were 6%. That was just changed in the current president's budget to 5.5%. And if I'm not mistaken, the Deficit Reduction Act brings the ceiling down even further to 3%. But I need to check on that for certainty.
That's after this.
That's in October 2000. 3% in, I believe, October 2009. It's 5.5% now.
I could clarify that, if I may. The 5.5% takes effect January 1, 2008. The 3% did not come into effect. 5.5% remains in place by federal law until at least, can't remember if it was 2010 or 2011, Senator Smith led an effort to ensure that that was put in statute.
Is that a canon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to run the risk of asking a very naive question that I have no idea what the answer is to, and it may walk right into the middle of a political thicket. But I wasn't here when these provider taxes
were
passed.
Only lawyers that aren't supposed to do that.
Well, I generally try not to, but I guess I'm struggling to understand the rationale for taxing providers for a service that you're trying to expand access to. If I was setting up a state program for recycling, for instance, and trying to make sure that could happen everywhere, I wouldn't at first think to tax the recyclers to pay for that program. And so when we're struggling with funding this funding Medicaid services for this population, when we're seeing premium costs rise across the board, why were providers looked at to pay for these services?
Representative Cannon, Chair Greenlick, I think that was an astute question, not a naive one. And I think that the reason for that is because of our ability to leverage federal dollars in addition to the tax dollars. So as an example, in our hospital tax, we have taxed the hospitals a percentage of their revenue. We have been able to use that revenue along with, as Lynn indicated, for every dollar, about $1.50 of federal dollars. We've been able to take that amount of money and we've been able to do two things with it. We've been able to increase hospital rates as well as increase our ability to serve some additional individuals. So we've been able to do two things. Likewise, in the managed care tax, we've been able to increase our coverage of individuals, as well as be able to increase some of the administrative expenses that the taxpayers, our administrative reimbursement for some of the expenses of the taxpayers. So we've been able to, in essence, create a dual purpose because of our ability to leverage federal dollars.
Sort of a simple answer is, well, we didn't promise this, if they give you a dollar, we give them $2.50 back.
We put $2.50 back into the system. There are not. It's not a direct $2.50 back. So there are, in essence, winners and losers based on our ability to. We've been able to increase some rates in our payment of hospitals, but certainly depending on the percentage of Medicaid patients that a provider may or may not take care of will directly affect their ability to sort of see any overall net change in what they get.
Just a very quick follow-up for clarification. Would it not also be the case that you would gain the federal match from taxing me and spending that money on OHP standard, right?
Yes.
Okay. Thanks.
So all these providers participate in the system, and they lose a little bit from the tax,
yeah.
And then overall we all gain from the additional revenues that come into the system.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Follow up on that. So it's an imperfect tool, but it's something the federal government allowed us to do, and at a crisis situation, we were able to leverage those dollars. Could, not to open up a can of worms, but hospitals and the managed care providers were part of this discussion. We didn't talk to anybody else about this at the time, because the federal government allows us to do other health care services to match.
Nursing homes as well.
Representative Kotek, Chair Greenlick, when the discussions began around the provider taxes, I think that initially there was an exploration and a discussion about how this might work with other groups as well. Why and how that dissipated, I don't know all of the details about, but there was certainly discussion about that. And this is where we ended up. And it was after quite a bit of discussion that we were able to, I think, come to an agreement about these taxes. I think primarily one of the issues was that the two groups that are being taxed, actually the three groups when you factor in nursing facilities, have done this were groups that also agreed to work with us on a voluntary basis, and that this was part of, the commitment amongst the taxpayers and the legislature was that these were groups that were able to agree to, in essence, allow themselves to be taxed and for us to be able to work through some of that. And we weren't able to get to the same place with other groups.
Thank you very much. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
We have four more witnesses on these two bills. We have Cindy Becker again, right? Uh-huh. Not accidental. Come on, Cindy. You want to come up with Kevin. All right. Let's see. Lynn Marie, who do you want to date? Would Ellen Finney be okay with you? I'm filling up here.
You go up with Kevin, and then we'll get Lynn Marie Kreider and Ellen Pinney.
Yep.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, again for the record, my name is Cindy Becker and I'm the director of the Coalition for Healthy Oregon.
I'm Kevin Earls, representing the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems.
What I've handed out to you actually is an excerpt from a spreadsheet that the department has put together on provider taxes, so you can get an idea of what the actual taxes have been collected to date and what the projections are through June of 07. So I always feel comfortable, more comfortable at least when I see some numbers, and so I thought this might be helpful to you. Again, I will keep my testimony very short. From our perspective, from the COHO perspective, this is a simple bill. It is to extend the existing managed care tax, and we support it. We think that, unfortunately, it's the only game in town for OHP standard clients. Would we prefer that it wasn't? Obviously, yes. But given the fact of where the state was and all the other priorities, we clearly want to at least keep those individuals who are currently getting served through OHP standard to keep those services. We are interested, however, in, I know the department has been talking, I think, to CMS. There may be quote-unquote extra dollars, if you will, when comparing the revenue and expenditures right now. And we're very anxious for standard to open up again as soon as possible. So we encourage you to support 2177. I won't speak for my esteemed colleague here, but we are very much in support of it. Thank you.
Are there any questions, Senator? Chair Representative Mara?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Question about the tax rates. I'm somewhat confused here. Your assessment, your tax rate is?
Mine's higher than Kevin's.
Yours is 5.8.
Right.
Yours yes. And I'll just ask the next question, and yours is something less than 1%, 0.68.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Kevin?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing us the opportunity to testify on this issue. I'd like to start with maybe a half a dozen points about, and I think this is much to Representative Cannon's question, why would you agree to tax yourself? But kind of five or six issues about provider taxes generally, and then some comments about 2183 and its development more specifically. So I'm not going to be quite as brief as those have gone before me, but I'll be brief. So why tax yourself? Well, we do it just to leverage federal funds. It's very simple. It's not as complicated as it may seem at times, but we just do it to draw down federal matching funds. And I think it was important for you to hear that the original purpose of enacting a hospital provider tax, at least, was to increase provider tax rates, or increase provider payment rates, hospital payment rates, and to standardize them. That didn't happen. The hospital tax was repurposed as a result of the failure of ballot measure 30. So it is important to remember that when we began this process, the idea was to actually try and supplement the state's relatively paltry payment levels to hospitals and other providers for participating in the Medicaid program, and that never happened. Actually, the providers, both Medicaid managed care plans and the hospital association, were actively involved in bringing the provider tax concept forward and brought consulting help in, helped work with the governor's office to develop these taxes and put them into place originally. We wanted to be taxed because we wanted to supplement the amount of money
that is available for funding the Medicaid program. And when you think about provider taxes, there are some rules that the feds require, but you are allowed within those rules to increase provider payments in the aggregate at the same time. And that's what we did for hospitals in this state. We increased hospital provider payments in the aggregate in an amount that directly offset the taxes that are paid. So when we talk about increasing provider payments, the truth is we only increased them in the aggregate sufficient to pay the tax back. So there was no net payment increase. And I think that's an important element to understand, because that helps you understand how long it has been since an already underpaid, underfunded, and inequitable system has been rebased and increased in funding. CMS allows this in concert with other conditions that that you have to meet in order to put a provider tax in place. But they don't like these taxes very well, and the current administration doesn't like them at all. And so one of the things that's absolutely essential in adopting a provider tax for a state is that the parties stand together and show unified support for a program when making application to CMS in order to see it approved. And that's very much the situation, been the situation here in Oregon, that the providers have stood together and helped supplement and help the state through a period of economic recession and really try and keep for the Medicaid managed care plans and the hospital hospitals involved, keep a little bit of a footprint of OHP standard in place, enough so that when the economy recovered in Oregon, the state could reinflate that program as circumstances would permit. The situation that we find ourselves in today is that 4 years has gone by and we've been funding OHP standard almost exclusively out of provider taxes. And the return of state funds to help fund OHP standard has been promised but not delivered. There was, in the governor's recommended budget, a series of restorations that I'd like to walk through, because they were developed as part of a package for the hospital association agreeing to an extension of the tax. Before I go through this, I just want to frame once more for emphasis. We helped develop this tax program. We brought it forward to help the state in a time of economic necessity. We were going to use it to help increase our own rates, but when ballot measure 30 was defeated, we repurposed the money in order to help the state keep OHP standard alive. That 4 years has passed, and now our obligation to that tax ends at the end of this calendar year. So with that in mind, the governor's office and representatives from DHS approached the hospital association about 6 months ago and said, what would it look like? What would it take for us to get your agreement again to extend this tax? And so we put together, in working with them, a package that is reflected in the governor's recommended budget. And I'll just hit the high points. We would add about $4 million, $5 million in general fund for fee-for-service rates to hospitals. This would help restore a portion of our rates, and a significant portion of it, of our rates, have actually declined while we've been in the provider tax period. So we're actually getting paid less today than we were 4 years ago. So a little bit of fee-for-service money to help kind of restore those rates. A restoration of a portion of the funding for the Medicaid managed care rates, which were originally funded at 100% of provider cost. So there was a statute in place that said, in effect, the state's actuary will set rates in the Medicaid managed care program sufficient to cover the cost of care. And that's a really important principle, and a cornerstone of the Oregon Health Plan originally was that we were going to discontinue cost shifting to the commercial sector by paying actual costs in the rates that Cindy's clients receive through the Medicaid managed care program. That funding was cut to 72% in the same time frame in order, again, to help the state through its economic recession. So a significant, although it wasn't restored to 100% in the governor's recommended budget, the governor recommended it be restored to 90% of the cost necessary to cover the cost of care, of levels necessary to cover the cost of care.
Is that in the $45 million that is part of the proposed tax on tobacco?
Vice Chair Richardson, it is. I have a total fund. I hedge a bit because I have a total fund number in front of me. It's $84 million total fund, so that sounds about right.
Okay.
The next was a commitment, kind of a first step in commitment to reinflating the enrollment in the Oregon Health Plan Standard Program. So we've dwindled down now to about 22,000. We were at about 85,000. I think we've actually been higher than that at one point. But the governor's recommended budget committed to restoring 10 to 15,000 people to that program in the coming biennium. Not nearly enough from our perspective, but it broke us free of gravity of doing nothing. At least it put 10 to 15,000 adults and couples back into coverage. And it did an important thing. It returned some general fund funding to OHP standard. Again, right now it's just coming from provider taxes and a little bit of premium money. And then the last thing was to equalize or re-equalize the hospital benefits that people in OHP standard and OHP plus receive. Right now, and again as a result of these cuts, that occurred in around 03, the benefits that a person receives, the hospital benefit that a person receives in OHP standard is actually less of a benefit than what's in plus. We supported that originally as a good idea or a good experiment, but what we found through implementation is it's virtually impossible to administer. I mean, when people come into a hospital, a lot of times we don't know if they're OHP standard or OHP plus. So it's like a good idea that didn't really work. And so there was a commitment to re-equalize these benefits at a total fund cost of about $8 million, so probably $2.5 million general fund. Then we asked for kind of four what I call non-financial considerations, kind of policy considerations. One is that if we could get these things, that we would link our taxes together so that they expired at the same time. Or if Congress or the administration discontinued one of them, that both would sunset at the same time. So that one or the other of the taxes wouldn't get left to fund the whole program or used for other purposes. When they go away together. The second was that, and this is kind of a technical issue, but it's really important. Hospitals can only be paid at a level that does not exceed what they would be paid under Medicare for the same service. That's called the Medicare upper payment limit. So while we got a tax and an aggregate increase in our rates, our payment rates, sufficient to offset the tax liability, you can't continue to raise the payment rate. In other words, you can't repeat the game. You have to stop at a level where reimbursement does not exceed what would be paid by Medicare for the same service. And in effect, we're right there. We've always been kind of right there. So yet some people have argued, well, we should raise the hospital tax rate above something less than 1%. We should raise it to 3% or 5% or the same as the managed care rate. The problem with that has been, and you'll hear about this in other testimony, is that that becomes a tax that can't be repaid through an increase in the rates. And so, in effect, it becomes a sick tax or a tax on people that in effect, all it does is raise the cost of care for those people that have health insurance. The third policy issue or kind of non-economic issue was that funds from the hospital tax would continue to fund hospital services. They weren't going to pay for prescription drugs or they were going to pay for other things, you know, outside of that setting. And the final one was that we are experiencing a tremendous increase in Oregon hospitals in uncompensated care, as you would expect. I mean, we have 23,000 people in OHP standard. So we're 60-some thousand people that don't have coverage anymore, and they have a very difficult time finding primary care access. So where do they go? They go to the emergency room. And as a result, we've had an increase in uncompensated care in Oregon hospitals during this time period from 2003 to 2006. It's gone from $400 million to $750 million. So you can see what kind of things are getting shifted onto other purchasers of health care with that reduction in the population served by OHP standard. So we asked in our fourth kind of consideration that DHS would develop a primary care referral system that we could use to redirect people from the emergency room to a more appropriate and less costly setting. With those considerations, we agreed to support the extension of a hospital tax. Now we're in the midst of kind of a gray area where we have the governor's recommended budget on one hand, we have a co-chair's budget we're going to see on Thursday. We don't know if these commitments have been funded in the co-chair's budget. We certainly hope they have. But that is what we have asked for as an agreement to extend the ability to leverage federal funds under the hospital tax. With that, I'll conclude my testimony at the chair's suggestion.
We do need to move on, and I appreciate that. I thought you'd be done before I got back. I was walking fast. Okay. Great, very much. Thank you very much, guys. Can we have Lynn Marie Kreider and Ellen Penny? And we'll close this session and move to the three other bills we have on our agenda. This is not trivial stuff, but the big action on these bills is going to have to happen in the Revenue Committee anyway. So my intention is to pull it out of here and on Friday move them to the Revenue Committee, which is where the real action has to happen anyhow.
Either one. Alphabetical?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, alphabetical means me. My name is Lynn Marie Kreider, and I'm here representing the Service Employees International Union. We are also here to support extension of the managed care and hospital provider taxes. While the taxes don't provide enough revenue to solve the crisis that we have in uninsurance in our state, they have served a valuable service in leveraging federal dollars to improve provider reimbursement rates and keep alive the vision of providing health care coverage to low-income adults who are not categorically eligible for Medicaid. I do want to suggest some principles that we believe should apply to consideration of expansion of provider taxes and for thinking about how we might do them differently that I just wanted to share with you. First, we believe that provider taxes are a necessary component of any plan to maximize the use of federal dollars. Two, we believe that provider taxes should be increased only if they'll enable us to actually enroll more Oregonians in health care in medical assistance programs, that they shouldn't be increases in provider tax shouldn't be used as a substitute for general fund funding for medical assistance programs. And three, the idea that we'd like to share with you is the notion that provider taxes should be based on ability to pay. Right now, as was described to you, provider taxes are based on revenue, on net patient revenue, which means essentially we're setting the tax rate based on volume of services that are being provided. And the fact is that if you look at the hospitals in this state, you will see that they vary greatly in how much they serve low-income people, what percentage of their what they call payer mix is Medicaid patients, what percentage are uninsured. And the charts that are attached to the testimony suggest to us that there is a correlation between a hospital's profitability and the extent to which it successfully avoids the poor, not surprisingly. But if you were to, on a revenue-neutral basis, tax based on, for example, net income, which is profit, instead of net patient revenue, you would modestly shift the burden of the tax to those hospitals with the greatest ability to pay and modestly, in effect, subsidize those carrying the greatest burden in the system. So we want to just share that as an idea to be considered as you think about the role of provider taxes in the funding of medical services in the state. That's all I have.
I think I can ask you a technical question. I'm interested in that slope in the last, very last slide. The R square is there. That's exactly right. So basically, this is only talking about 10% of the variation in those things, even though the slope is
11%. Mr. Chair, yes, you'll notice that the slope is greater, although we don't have the line there in the chart for the Portland metro area. You see a greater contribution or a greater correlation between profit and what I call avoidance of the poor in the metro area. And I think that's because in a lot of towns, in Bend, everybody goes to the same hospital, rich or poor. In the Portland metro area, there's a greater ability, and maybe in some other communities, but primarily in the metro area, to locate geographically in a way that skews your payer mix, to conduct your business in a way that means that you see a larger share of privately insured as opposed to low-income patients.
That's a quarter of the variance explained.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Any other questions, or should we ask Ellen first?
For the record, my name is Ellen Pinney. I work with the Oregon Health Action Campaign. We thank Representative Kotek and members of this committee for this opportunity of a day's worth of hearings to shed light on the standard population. They have disenrolled from Oregon Health Plan Standard in the tens of thousands. They are lost but not forgotten. As Dr. Smith testified, I believe, and I would just like to reiterate, in July of 2002, 102,000 people were enrolled in what has now become known as OHP Standard. 10 months after the implementation of premiums, the enrollment was down to 51,000. We are now actually, according to DMAP numbers, at fewer than 20,000 person enrollment in OHP Standard. And that is divided into single adults at 12,400 and adults with children at 7,200. That's a decline of about 700 since last month. The disproportional impact of the decline in enrollment, which hit hardest on people with incomes less than 10% of the federal poverty level, should not have been hard to predict. I served on the waiver application steering committee that developed the waiver for the Oregon Health Plan 2 application. And one of the most striking pieces of information we received was that 40% of the Oregon Health Plan Standard population at that time lived with incomes less than 10% of the federal poverty level. Needless to say, the imposition of copays and premiums on this population struck many of us as poor public policy, serving, in fact, not to save money by controlling unnecessary utilization, but to save money by dumping people who needed it most off the plan. The Oregon Health Plan standard population never fit neatly into the little boxes that have been created to understand who the uninsured are in our state. They are not the traditional working uninsured. They suffer disproportionately from mental health conditions. Because of their struggle with mental health and alcohol and dependency issues, this population is disproportionately under or intermittently employed. It is precisely because of their need that it makes sense to figure out a way to provide more, if not all of them, with access to service. It is precisely because of their employment status that traditional proposals for financing universal coverage, like payroll assessments, do not hit the mark. It's precisely because of the enormous strain they put on hospital and correctional systems that it makes sense to figure out how best to ensure that this population has access to preventive services. This legislature has the opportunity and the tools to change the dynamic of continuing reduction or holding steady on the Oregon Health Plan population, Oregon Health Plan standard, to reinstate access to basic health care, including mental health and prescription drugs, for the thousands of Oregonians who've lost coverage. We encourage you to consider immediate steps for reinstating access for some or all of this population in the context of the many proposals you will be considering for longer-term gain of universal coverage. Like many others who will testify today, we do support the continuation, extending the sunset on the hospital and provider assessments that currently provide the Oregon Health Plan standard population with coverage. It's important to point out that in our perspective, these are not taxes. These assessments are used to draw down federal money, and they are returned to the payers in the form of higher reimbursement rates. There are no additional costs to either the hospitals or the Medicaid managed care plans that provide them. But our coalition supports more than just the continuation of the hospital and Medicaid managed care assessments. We support a serious look at a mechanism that would assess all providers a nominal amount that would then be used to draw down the federal match that's integral to reinstating coverage for this population. To folks who will argue that a provider assessment will just be cost-shifted, I beg a look at the cost of the hospital emergency room or the cost of incarceration that is incurred every time one of these standard populations does not get the services they need. By the end of next session, as Representative Kotek pointed out, the current OHP Medicaid managed care plans assessment will run into federal change of regulations. Why not take action right now to remedy that problem? If equity is a concern, it seems by far more equitable to get all plans that benefit from reducing the uninsurance rate to pay into the program, including those that no longer play in the Medicaid market at all. If equity is concerned, it makes, in fact, the most sense that the assessment should be the same for all providers allowed to be assessed under federal law. We encourage you to pencil out the numbers and take a look now, this session, at doing more than holding the line on the current enrollment or expanding coverage by 10 to 15,000. Thank you so much.
I think we've segued into the discussion on 3057, 58, and 59, so let me close the public hearing on 2177 and 2183, and ask, you folks can hang in if you'd like, ask Representative Kotek if she'd introduce the other three bills which you are both testifying on. Oh, yes, I thought I had done that. I'm opening a public hearing on 3057, 3058, 3059, and we'll ask our Vice Chair to introduce those bills for us.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here today. For the record, I'm Tina Kotek. I'm State Representative for House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. Before I talk about the other bills, I just want to say that I wholeheartedly support the two other bills that we just talked about. These numbers I don't have in front of me. But the extension of what we've been doing is important. We need to protect the 24,000 lives that we can
protect with insurance if we extend the current the managed care tax and the hospital tax. And I just want to say that I want to thank the hospitals, the managed care, Medicaid managed care plans, and the long-term care facilities for agreeing to these assessments to leverage federal dollars. It has kept Oregon Health Plan standard alive, and I think that's very important. That being said, the reason that I wanted to introduce House Bill 3057, 3058, and 3059 was that on the horizon, we are looking at the elimination of the Medicaid managed care tax. And that's a big problem, as we've heard already. But I also think that everything should be on the table when we are talking about trying to reduce the number of uninsured in the state. If we're going to bring back some of the individuals who would be eligible for the Oregon Health Plan standard, then we need to have a serious conversation about how we're going to do that. Now, do I profess to believe that these bills are the perfect vehicle? No. But if we don't put anything forward and talk about it, we just won't talk about it, and we have to, because our rates of uninsured in the state are going up. It's affecting the entire system. It's affecting insurance premium costs, all the healthcare systems, whether it's the uncompensated care in the hospitals or the cost of our insurance premiums. We all have to deal with this. Now, there are universal coverage discussions going on, as we know. And I hope very much that those come to fruition and we actually solve some problems here in 2 to 4 years. In the meantime, we have a short-term problem of not enough folks being covered. And so we have to get back to the conversation of how do we bring back what was the Oregon Health Plan. The folks that have lost coverage are those expanded populations that don't meet categorical eligibility to the Oregon Health Plan Plus package. But that's what we had in mind for the health plan when we started it, to cover those adults and other individuals that don't automatically qualify for Medicaid. So just to wrap up, we have this danger on the horizon in terms of how, if we can continue to do the provider taxes. And the question is, are we all going to share the burden? The one that I'm most interested in discussing is 3057 in many ways, because what I attempted to do there is say, well, we have other options in terms of leveraging federal dollars. What does the federal government allow us to do in terms of assessing other health care providers? What you have in 3057 is the list from the Federal Register of the other types of services that we can leverage assessments on to get federal match. I would hope that anybody on that list is going to come up and say something, and maybe they won't, or they're going to end up in my office, which is fine. But I think we just can't depend on the managed care plans, the Medicaid managed care plans, and the hospitals to bail us out of this situation. So I think we have to look at everyone and how we share the burden across the entire healthcare system. So with that, I'll stop and be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a quick question of Representative Kotek?
You can even ask a slow question.
Well, I'll ask a slow question that she'll answer quickly. Slow because it'll take me that long to really figure it out. But I think it's simply what can you very clearly explain what will happen on a federal level and when? I'm sorry, I've been trying to track this conversation, but if you could say that again. I know you've talked about it before.
Well, certainly. Chair Greenlink, Representative Cannon. Well, just first, if we do not extend the current provider taxes
right. And
the other two bills, we have no money for standards. So
but
that's
assuming that we do.
But assuming we do. At October 1, 2009, we can no longer just assess the Medicaid managed care plans. We have to assess all managed care plans. That is what the Deficit Reduction Act requires. And so that's what you see in 3058. That's an attempt to say, should we assess all managed care plans? I'm not even sure what that total definition means these days, but that's what that one is about. There is some discussion about the different rates at which we can assess, and I'm not totally up to speed on that. What you'll see in my bills are I ask legislative counsel to just give me the maximum that you can assess at, and that's the top of the scale there. But some of those numbers have been adjusted too, and as has been mentioned, federal government is not so excited about these assessments. Now, that might change with a different administration, but it's a lot of uncertainty if we're going to make sure that we can fund the Oregon Health Plan for this population.
So just to clarify, on October 1st, 2009, the federal government will prohibit this sort of targeted assessment to a single group of managed care companies and hospitals.
That's correct.
Would you? I think that describes what we're talking about in 3058. How does 3059 differ in the hospital task compared to what we're looking at in 2183?
Thank you, Chair Greenlich. 3059 removes the sunset on the assessment to hospitals and increases it to 5.5%. It's currently at about a little less than 1%. And to be fair to everybody, I thought, well, if we're going to have a bill on the managed care plans, we should have a hospital bill as well. And this is to some degree a placeholder, but we cannot, you know, leave a significant part of our healthcare system out of the discussion. So that's where the 5.5 comes. That is the max at which we could assess.
And what kind of providers are included in 3057? What is that list of providers?
Thank you, Chair Greenlich. Well, currently, the federally defined classes of health care that are not subject currently to provider taxes are, there's a whole host of them. Physician services, home health services, ambulatory surgical care centers, dental services.
These are not?
Not. These are not currently assessed. But according to the Federal Register, they could assess them.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Yes. Podiatric services, chiropractic services, optometric services, psychological services, therapist services, nursing services at hospital, laboratory and x-ray, and emergency and ambulance services. So we have other options. Now the challenge becomes on how we would actually, what would the mechanism would be for collecting the assessment and leveraging the dollars, but we have other options. And I think everything should be on the table in terms of what we should consider.
Thank you. And any of you could answer this. Has anyone seen any research into the question of if we spent another dollar that presumably a provider tax would provide and leverage the, was it $2.5 or $1.25 from federal government to expand our standard population, what that does for the uncompensated care that hospitals are currently, and this is probably a question for the hospitals as well, but uncompensated care that they're currently soaking up. I mean, there may be some sort of magic number in here. You're proposing quite a big jump in that hospital provider, that hospital tax rate, but is there some way of sort of costing this out that it actually ends up looking good because there's a lot less uncompensated care as we expand the eligibility for OHP standard?
Chair Greenlich, Representative Cannon, I think that's a great question. I think currently the way our hospital assessment is set up, there is no net loss. But one could argue that with the growing amount of uncompensated care the hospital is providing, we get more people on Oregon Health Plan, less uncompensated care. So I think there is a financial benefit. I don't know if that's been calculated. I'm going to throw this to Ellen and Lynn Marie. Do you have any?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cannon, I don't know the precise answer. I'd be glad to share with you what I can gather. One of the things that has happened around the country is that there's been a huge increase in uncompensated care, and I think there's a lot of speculation about what that is. A piece of it is certainly the growth of uninsured. There is speculation that a piece of that is the growth in high deductible plans, increased cost sharing, and really a feeling among researchers and analysts that we need to get to the bottom of how much of it is which piece of this. And so I don't have an answer. I can just say yes, it's a good question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cannon, I would second what other folks have said here. I don't have the precise numbers, but if we can possibly get them, I would encourage you also to look at the cost to the correctional institutions. I remember hearing a superintendent of a correctional institution in Eastern Oregon say, we are seeing more and more people here who have fallen off Oregon Health Plan standard and are unable to maintain their meds, and we are a mental health institution by default, and I need you to think about how much it costs me to keep someone in my institution for one day as opposed to how much it would cost to keep them on standard for a month. And for one day, I think the cost is substantially higher.
And if I could, Chair Greenlich, Representative Cannon, I think
sitting on the Ways and Means Subcommittee, I think one of the challenges is we don't look across the system. We could look at the foster care system. Folks who don't have access to A&D treatment, more likely their kids might end up in foster care. So we have across the system some challenges. It would make for a fascinating and, I think, very important actuarial study to look at some of that so we'd get a sense that it's not just about our little silo of the Oregon Health Plan, but system-wide what we're doing in terms of corrections, child welfare, other places.
That's really an important point. Representative, thank you for bringing these bills. We have a few people who have some interest in them.
Thank you very much.
Let's see if we can get a little testimony before we before our coach turns into a pumpkin. Jim Carlson? No. John Mullen Kelso, is it? Oh, also, yeah.
Also.
I see. There we got it, John. We've seen you before. And maybe Klaus Martin, please. Kelso, that's good.
Yeah, I think,
I mean, we have all three open. I think basically we're talking about all three simultaneously or any one of them.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
I didn't expect you to see you here today. You're the only one who's not in this stuff.
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jim Carlson, director of the Oregon Healthcare Association, actually has a charter member of volunteering for the provider tax. House Bill 3057, I think, due to the way it's drafted, would impact your existing nursing facility provider tax due to some of the language in Section 2B, which is intended, I think, to exempt out any of that existing revenue. But it makes references to current law under chapter laws. And once the existing tax would be sunsetted and a reauthorization would come in, I think that would impact that so that after that period of time you would be pulling that tax in and other taxes in, whether that was the intent or not. And so I wanted to point out from a technical standpoint, had some concerns just with the way this is crafted. We obviously supported strongly back in the 2003 session of the legislature the existing nursing facility provider tax and believe it's been a pretty good win-win for the state. There's a couple reasons for that. And if I might, to Representative Cannon's question earlier on kind of the why, I think some context is important to understand, which is we were coming off a very tough 2001-03 biennium in which we had inadequate general fund resources available in order to keep federal funds flowing, and we had five special sessions during that interim between the 2001 session and the 2003 session. And in a perfect world, we would much rather have general fund dollars in to support these programs and services, but unfortunately, there was a lack of available general fund at that time, and so we went down this road. Our current tax sunsets mid-biennium. We have separate legislation in the Revenue Committee, House Bill 2563, to reauthorize that, and we've been meeting with the Department of Human Services since last fall, working out details in regard to that legislation. And so if this bill does move forward on 3057, we would like to make sure that we're dealing with what some of those technical issues might be that would be in conflict.
Oh, no, but other than that, you have no problem with 3057.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we're very supportive of extending on the nursing facility piece. I don't want to speak for other provider organizations or groups. I mean, I'd say come on in, the water's fine, but the fact of the matter is nursing facilities are somewhat unique in that the lion's share of their revenue that they receive comes from the Medicaid program, and so a provider tax funding mechanism means that you have many more winners than losers in the provider equation when you look at the taxes paid and dollars back. Now, we do have losers. I was on the phone this morning. You've got one in your district. I was on the phone this morning with a past board chair of mine. They pay in over $300,000 a year in provider taxes, and they do not have a Medicaid contract. And so we do have many providers who took one for the team, so to speak, back in 2003. So with that, I'd be happy to respond to questions. And you do have a handout that just shares generally some of the information. You can see some of the impact that the nursing facility provider taxes had. You do have a chart that shows we've got dramatically less general fund in the program today than we did a couple bienniums. And at the same time, we've been able to increase the funding levels through leveraging those federal dollars.
Thank you. Mr. Mullen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members also of the subcommittee. It's an interesting addition to my name. I'll have to think about that one. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center, and I'll be very brief today. Basically, what the Oregon Law Center does is works on behalf of low-income people, and the members of the community that contact our offices around the state are very concerned about the loss of health care access. Previous testimony has demonstrated how much the Oregon Health Plan Standard Program has changed and shrunk to the level that it is currently. And I've been following with great interest and have seen many of you on Mondays and Wednesday nights as you struggle with the major issues that are before us about looking at the reform of health care in the state of Oregon. But, of course, there are people that are struggling every day as we speak that have lost access to health care, and I'm here on their behalf. I would just submit a couple of very quick examples of populations that have not been previously discussed today. There are also folks that are on getting close to Medicare age that are not in the workforce, that are no longer eligible for OHP standard. And we see at our offices around the states people that are really destitute, unable to be in the workforce for a variety of reasons and have no access to health care. Another example is the loss of the general assistance program, and with that went OHP plus eligibility. And many of those people have either disappeared or if they do apply, don't meet presumptive criteria for Medicaid or may not then be eligible because OHP standard, of course, is capped. And so all that I would say just in summarizing is that I think the testimony here today about the fact that we all have suffered as Oregonians in seeing the loss of OHP standard, and I just hope that everything that you're discussing and thinking about in a comprehensive way will also look at the practical considerations of OHP standard. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, Dr. Martin.
Chair Greenlake, members of the subcommittee. For the record, my name is Dr. Klaus Martin from McMinnville. I have been in solo private practice as a family physician for 30 years. Today, I am representing the Oregon Medical Association, the OMA. Your subcommittee has three bills before you that would either extend or expand provider taxes, House Bill 2183, House Bill 3057, and 3058. Now, I have been in Oregon now for 30 years, and I don't hear my accent anymore, but I still sometimes have hard time with certain words. So if there is one word comes out and it doesn't make sense to you, raise your hand and maybe I get it straight. But my patients don't mind, and my wife doesn't know I have an accent anymore either.
I don't think we're having a problem understanding what you're saying.
OMA policy strongly opposes the imposition of targeted provider taxes. The OMA supports the use of broad-based general fund revenues for the funding of Medicaid and other government health care programs. Physicians and other health care providers do pay significant corporate and personal income taxes. In at least two other instances, when physician-provider tax was proposed to either fund the Oregon Health Plan or to supplement declining revenues, the OMA has strongly opposed the legislation. The OMA and the physicians we represent believe that state policy should use broad-based tax resources for the implementation of its priority programs whenever it is possible. Each time the legislature has had an increase in general fund revenues, it repeatedly chosen not to focus on the priority of a permanent and sustainable solution for funding of the Oregon Health Plan. To during the last recession, the legislature chose to reduce the numbers who were insured by the Oregon Health Plan. Now, the legislature is in a heated debate to expand health insurance coverage for all children using increased tobacco taxes to fund the program. The OMA supports this effort and agrees that the policy to connect the ill effects of tobacco products makes sense and is good public health policy. The proposed bills before you ignore the reality of medical practice in Oregon. The Medicaid program does not reimburse providers for the cost of providing health care. The current reimbursement covers only approximately 60% of the physician's cost. Not only does the physician himself not get any pay for the time he spent in providing care, but he has to shift the overhead costs associated with each Medicaid Oregon Health Plan patient visit to his other paying patients. 41% of Oregon physicians either limit or do not accept Medicaid patients. In a recent survey, over 90% of physicians reported that the lack of adequate payment for medical services from the Oregon Health Plan was a major reason for this decision not to accept Oregon Medicaid patients. For several years, medical practice income for Oregon physicians has either not increased or has been declining. For example, Medicare reimbursement for Oregon physicians has not kept pace with the cost of providing health care. Oregon physicians are again threatened by a projected 10% reduction in the Medicare fee schedule for 2008. This rate is less than the Medicare reimbursement rate of 2001. There are no indications that physicians can hope to recover these provider revenue losses.
Mr. Klauske, can I ask you to move down to the summary?
I think we'll understand exactly what you're saying.
There's a very important part I want to give you, because we are encouraged that the committee's chair, Senator Bates, and Senator Westland are seriously trying to establish a credible process that will provide universal access to standard health care benefit for all Oregonians. This standard health care benefit program would include a permanent and sustainable funding source. The OIM is concerned that the number of uninsured Oregonians. The OIM is committed to work with the legislature to find a clear path of universal coverage. Physicians, on the average, provide about 5% of their practice to charity and unfunded care each year. Physicians believe this is part of their professional obligation. There are many individuals and county programs that assist the uninsured in areas like Bend, Eugene, Corvallis, Salem, and Portland. The bills before you will make it more difficult to recruit physicians to Oregon. The bills before you will make it difficult to retain physicians who recently relocated to Oregon. Passage of these bills will further worsen the projected physician shortage, especially in our rural communities. At this time, I would like to explain how the bill before you would affect a small solo physician's private practice, like my own. My employees have a SEP IRA, a Simplified Employee Pension Plan. I have contributed the maximum allowed, which is 15% of the gross salary.
I really have to ask you to finish up your testimony, please.
Okay. What this proposed tax does to my private practice, it increases my tax liability, Oregon income tax, by 154%. And if this happens, who wants to come to Oregon? So, in summary, the OMA respectively strongly opposes House Bill 3057. In addition, should House Bill 3050 move out of committee, the OMA respectively requests the term physician care organization be struck from line 14 and 15. Physician care organizations are not currently included is a provision adopted by the last legislature for hospital and nursing homes. I would like to thank you for giving consideration to the concerns of Oregon physicians and for this opportunity to testify today.
Thank you very much. Can I ask
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank Dr. Martin for being here. And it is not my intent with 3057 to unduly burden doctors like yourself. I also understand that we have a capacity issue when we're reimbursing physicians at 60% of their costs. I just want to throw an idea out there. First of all, there's no percentage in that bill, particularly right now. The other issue is if we can raise enough dollars by having a smaller percentage assessed across the healthcare industry, and we can raise the dollars, we can increase what we reimburse physicians for, and that will increase access. So I'm not opposed to that. So I think to say that we would continue to reimburse at the level we are if we can raise additional revenue, I don't think that would be my intent. So I just want to point that out. But
Representative Kotek, Chair Greenblick. I came to Oregon 1977. In 1977, my Oregon health plan, Medicaid reimbursement was 90% of my regular fees for commercial. Now, we're down 40%. My overhead has gone up. There have been promises. The promise has not funded. So if we want to go to provider tax, this is a sales tax. This is a medical service sales tax. Why don't we have a sales tax on all teachers for providing medical, for teaching? We can have a tax on the people who do highway construction to fund the highway program. This is a sales tax. This is a medical services, good and services tax. And that's what it is. And so if we want to be honest, I support a sales tax, but let's make it a sales tax for everything. Put a sales tax in, and then we have it in general revenues. Everybody participates. We're not picking at one area. We are taxing the sick, and the physician cannot pass that cost on to Oregon Health Plan. The physician cannot pass that cost on to Medicare. The physician cannot pass that cost on to the other health plans because they have said that's the maximum. We don't pay more.
And I appreciate that comment. Thank you, Dr. Martin. But we can also leverage federal dollars by raising assessments this way. And I realize that perhaps there's a better way to fund, to stabilize our general fund. But I think Chair Greenlick had a question. So we can talk more.
Let me avoid gaveling down before we get the next two witnesses.
Chair Greenlick and Representative Kotek, the previous hospital representative testified that the legislator did not follow through on the promise to increase their funding. So even so we make that promised funding, that doesn't mean the next session, 2 years from now, it's going to be reneged, and it's just another tax. It is a huge impact. It is greater than it would cost me right now for my SEP IRA and some medical reimbursement, where I'm reimbursing my employees with the medical insurance premium, the dental, and all out of medical care.
I'm not sure it's exactly what Mr. Earle said, and the profits of the hospital over the last year doesn't look like that's been a problem, but we'll get him back on this before we're done. Can I have Nan Heim and Sarah Myers, please? Kevin, do you want to make sure you have a last word as well on these three bills, or do we have a clear understanding of your position on them?
Well, thank you, Chair Greenlee.
We'd be glad to give you a word. We'll save the last word for you. Nan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Nan Heim, and I am here today representing the Oregon State Ambulance Association. Our members provide 911 emergency ambulance service by contract to cities and counties throughout the state. I just want to say that a provider tax definitely strikes fear into the hearts of our association's members. However, we do share your concern about missing out on federal Medicaid dollars that should be coming into the state. And I guess what I kept thinking back there is, show me the math so I can show our members the math. I also just want to make a couple of points. One is, the service that our members provide is mandated. There is no ability to limit or deny service to anyone who is underinsured or uninsured. Usually the personnel on an emergency ambulance have no idea whether the patient has any insurance at all, and they don't find out until later when they get that information from the hospital. The other point I wanted to make is that we are a very small part of the picture. Last session, the subcommittee chaired by Representative Richardson approved a line item increase of OMAP reimbursement for ambulance service to OMAP patients of $167,000. And with the matching Medicaid dollars, that increased reimbursement for emergency calls by about $50 a call. It's still only about half of the cost of providing that service, but it was an important increase.
So you're saying you don't do, I heard Dr. Kitzhaber refer to a wallet biopsy to find out if the patient was Blue Cross negative at the time. How do you manage the fact that some people just don't have any money to pay?
Mr. Chair, it's a growing huge problem for ambulance service providers. The state used to reimburse for the cost of serving uninsured motor vehicle accident victims, hospitals and ambulance providers, through the Motor Vehicle Accident Fund. It was paid for by driver's license fees, and we that was a good reliable source, but unfortunately the Attorney General said it was unconstitutional, and that has totally disappeared, and now there is no reimbursement whatsoever. And I have to say that the growing problem of uncompensated, undercompensated care, and there are areas in the state where their patient mix is as high as 70%, Medicare, Medicaid, and uncompensated care. It is definitely affecting the kind of care that you will see in this state in the years to come.
Thank you. So you're not interested necessarily in a tax, even if it allowed you to get more reimbursement?
I think, as I said, I would have to see the math and go over it with the members of my association. But we're interested in exploring ways to improve the mix, definitely. But a provider tax scares them. Thank you.
Ms. Myers?
Thank you, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Myers. I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Association for Home Care. Just wanted to briefly make some comments this afternoon regarding House Bill 3057. Our membership is composed of Medicare-certified home health agencies from across the state that provide nursing, therapy services, social workers, home health aid services in a patient's home. There are currently approximately 60 of those agencies located throughout the state of Oregon, and we represent about 95% of those. Not all of those home health agencies provide Medicaid services currently, and that is due primarily to the excessively low reimbursement rates that are paid by the state under fee-for-services, currently, which is at about 38 cents on the dollar for the cost of service. Additional issues that home health agencies face result in administrative barriers, for example, the cost and the time it takes to get a prior authorization through the Medicaid program is becoming increasingly difficult for the agencies to realize. Further, Medicaid patients are at a much higher level of acuity and are requiring a greater number of resources in order to manage. And these resources, again, are nowhere near enough to cover the services being provided at the current cost level as compared to the reimbursement rate. Presently, services under the standard plan do not cover home health and services nor therapy services. Those services were cut in terms of the benefit reductions some time ago. Under the Oregon Health Plan Plus program, there are co-pays that are required for home health and therapy services, and we feel that these are an additional access barrier for patients who may not be able to afford those services with having to pay for that co-pay. The proposal itself, we feel it's very complex, and we think that the needs of each provider group do need to be considered in order to determine the tolerance level for any such new provider tax that may result. We didn't think that a blanket tax is the best approach, and maybe that's not what is currently being considered, as Representative Kotek stated that perhaps that this is just an idea to germinate the development of some more broader-based tax proposal. Home health agencies at present have not had any opportunity to discuss or respond to a proposed tax on revenues, how it might be structured, an appropriate methodology, collection, et cetera. And we would definitely want an opportunity to comment and work with Representative Kotek and others on the development of any such tax to assure it serves the patients, the providers, and the Oregon Health Plan in the manner intended. And finally, I just would like to say that while home health agencies may not be ultimately opposed to a well-crafted approach that may increase rates and access to services, we need the time to review the best approach, and we would hope that we would have that opportunity to do so. Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions? Thank you very much.
Last word. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for giving me
the last
opportunity to speak. I think just addressing the three proposals that Representative Kotek has brought forward, first of all, I think, you know, we welcome the conversation. It's helpful, I think, to engage in the dialogue so that we feel like we have all the options that we can identify out on the table. We, as an association, are very concerned about the tendency for looking to a provider tax as a kind of a opportunity to dodge the difficult challenge of providing adequate funding for the Oregon Health Plan. And while we helped develop a provider tax program to help the state during a period of crisis, it's not a viable long-term strategy for a state to help fund its Medicaid program. And if we look at levels of insurance and levels of uncompensated care, in the period of the mid-90s, when the Oregon Health Plan was instituted, what we see is that we had very low levels of uncompensated care, and we had significant reductions in the people without insurance. Not surprisingly, during that same time, Oregon was above the national average in terms of the percentage of general fund funding for the state Medicaid program. So compared to other states, we put a higher percentage of our general fund into Medicaid. We had a good result from that. But in the course of the past 8 years or so, we've seen very significant reductions. The good doctor from the OMA talked about his own experience. We've seen such dramatic reductions in the payment levels that we now have a shortage of providers. We're shifting care to the emergency room. At the end of the day, we really need to kind of come back to the beginning and say this is a broad-based social obligation. It needs to have a broad base of tax support, whether that's a general fund income tax or whether it's a broad tax like Medicaid or managed care premiums or a payroll tax or something broad. I think that's probably where we'll have the greatest opportunity. But, you know, there's no silver bullet here with provider taxes to get us there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And thank you all for your testimony. And thank you very much, Representative Kotek, for bringing these things to us. We need to keep talking about where we go with them as the session emerges. And I do want to remind you, this is today. Okay, you are all welcome to join the Senate committee. Our committee is meeting with them. They're talking about, they're comparing the concepts of Senate Bill 329-27 and HB 3368. Governor Kitzhaber and Senators Bates and Westland have agreed to create a single bill. My understanding is a bill has gone down to LC to try and combine Senate Bill 27 and 329. And there have been meetings in a variety of places over the last week to move that along. So we will be reconvening if there is a quorum down in room 50 at 5 o'clock.
No later than 5 o'clock. Well, maybe a little later than 5 o'clock. I close the public hearing on House Bill 3057, 3058, 3059. Thank you all for your attention, and adjourn the meeting on the Subcommittee on Healthcare Access of the House Committee on Healthcare.